Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. 25 years ago, 800,000 people in the African nation of Rwanda were killed, and another million displaced during a brutal civil war. In the span of 100 days, intertribal tensions exploded into civil war following the assassination of the Rwandan president. It was one of the worst genocides of the 20th century. However, Rwanda has made a remarkable recovery. There will be a panel discussion tonight at Dickinson College in Carlisle entitled Rwanda at 25. We're joined on today's Smart Talk with the participants in that discussion. Joining us is Her Excellency Ambassador Mathilde Mukantabana, the Ambassador of the Republic of Rwanda to the United States of America. Ambassador, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be with you this morning.
Also joining us is Dickinson College President Dr. Margie Ensign, a scholar on Africa who has written about Rwanda and the genocide. Dr. Ensign, good to see you again.
Thank you for having us.
Also joining us is Dickinson College student and Rwandan native Nelly Tita Netwale. Ms. Netwale, I'm glad to meet you today.
Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Ambassador Mukantabana, 800,000 people, or 800,000 to 1 million, that's an estimate, killed in a three-month period, 1994. Another 1 million people displaced. What happened that started what became known as the genocide? And I understand that's not the official name as it is called, but what happened that started this bloodshed?
Thank you so much. What started was that it was a campaign that lasted more than three decades to discriminate and kill the Tutsi people. So genocide in 1994 was the conclusion of an intense campaign that had oppressed the Tutsi people since 1962 after independence from Belgium. The two subsequent administrations that took power were unable to bring the Rwandan people together, and one group was targeted, and it was the Tutsi people, who were on a number of occasions were driven to exile or were killed in the country. So 1994 was really like a conclusion of what had started a few decades before.
Yeah, and maybe it's good to provide some background. Who are and were the Tutsi people, but also the Twa, am I pronouncing that correctly, TWA, and also moderate Hutus. From what I understand, it was Hutu elites who were doing a lot of this planning, but who were these, and is it correct to say that these were different tribes?
It's true that we had three groups of people called, and you said it very well, the Hutu, Tutsi, and Twa. Prior to colonialism, before Africa was colonized by most countries in Europe in the 19th century, Rwanda was a kingdom with distinct groups, but who were not really different categories of people. There was a social mobility among the groups. They were more like social classes than ethnic groups. But during colonialism, initially it was by Germany. When Germany lost World War I, we were given to Belgium under the mandate of the United Nations. Before it was the League of Nations and then the United Nations. The categories were polarized, so the Tutsi Hutu became almost racialized groups, and polarization among the people happened. We were given identity cards that became almost the instrument of death. So each individual was given an identity with the ethnic group Tutsi, Hutu, and Twa. So if you go all the way to 1994, you'll find that that simple identity was an instrument of death. If we were on a roadblock, they looked at your identity and you were killed. That was also used to put a quota system, whether you needed to go to school or to become a part of the government entity. Tutsis were given 1% throughout the decades of the 60s. That's why most people left the country, because also sporadically they would kill people. They would kill Rwandans, and thousands were driven to exile. That's why the majority of the Tutsi people, when genocide happened, were also living outside of the country, in neighboring countries or in European country capitals or in the United States for a long time. So genocide, as I said, was a conclusion of many different things. Yeah, well, I wanted to say that eventually you've heard the facts that the plane carrying the president of Rwanda was shut down, and then genocide started. That was a spark that continued what had started for almost 3 years.
Yeah, this was not like the kind of assassination that we're unfortunately most used to hearing about. I mean, the president of Rwanda's plane was shot down. Dr. Anson, you have written and studied extensively in Rwanda, and from what I understand, you're also good friends with the ambassador. How would you describe, I mean, from what the ambassador describes, just trying to get the audience to understand, this almost sounds like what today would be called ethnic cleansing.
Well, genocide is a legal term, as you know, and it was genocide against the Tutsis. And as the ambassador points out, genocide is always planned. It's never spontaneous. And the planning had been going on for at least 3 decades before the spark, as she described, in 1994.
What made the Tutsis unique in Rwandan society or culture?
Well, as the ambassador described, during colonialism, first by the Germans and then the Belgians, the Belgians ruled indirectly, and they ruled through Tutsi leadership, and that created some tension within the country. There were so many players involved in this, including the Catholic Church, unfortunately, including the French, who armed some of the genocidaires. So it's a complex story, but it's a reminder of what can happen when governments are determined to exterminate part of their population.
Mm-hmm. When you say the Catholic Church, correct me if I'm wrong, the Catholic Church kind of adopted or took the side of the Tutsis, is that correct?
They did. They did. In fact, a very important document was printed in a local newspaper not long before the genocide, the Hutu Ten Commandments, that was endorsed by the church in country. And it justified the killing of the Tutsis in language that ordinary people could understand. But unfortunately, there were priests and nuns involved in the killing. My interest in deep affection for Rwanda goes back to a student I had before the genocide who actually went home, found refuge in a church, but was a firsthand observant of what the priest there was doing in terms of killing Tutsis. Mm. So it's a horrible story. It's complicated. It's historical. There were many actors, but I think we need to remember that genocide is never spontaneous. It was planned for many decades.
I want to talk, and I'm going to jump around a little bit here and go back to some of the history as well, but Nelly Tita Netwali, you were born, I'm assuming you're 22, right? But in your early 20s. So you were born after the genocide. But what's your background?
I was actually born in 2000, so I'm 19 right now. But
oh, you are?
Yes.
I got bad information then. I was told 22. I don't want to add years to you. Okay.
No.
Okay.
But yes, I was born years after the genocide. I was born in a very different time than my parents did, than a lot of people who were born before the genocide lived. Like, I was born with a country. A lot of my parents were not born with a country. They had a country, but for me, it was a different type of a country, because I was born in a time of peace where I knew where I was born, it was where I was going to be. Like, I was going to be part of rebuilding and making my country. But when my parents were born, it wasn't like that.
So what have you heard over the years about the genocide?
I've heard stories from people. I've heard a lot of testimonies from people who have experienced it firsthand, who lived through it. A lot of my family did live through it. Yes, and I've learned the history throughout. I learned it in my country. I also learned it while I was here, and basically learned it from my parents' stories too.
your parents experience or witness some of the brutality that occurred?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Also, a lot of my family members, I never got to meet them because they died during the genocide. And my dad was very, like, very involved in liberating some of the Tutsis, too. So,
in what way?
He was part of the liberation. Mm-hmm.
But in the military?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Ambassador, let me turn back to you and some of that history as well. One of the aspects of this, and as President Ensign pointed out, genocide is, you know, it is an official term. But one of the things that is so unique, unfortunately, about this was this three-month period was known for its brutality and also the sexual violence. I mean, I'm not going to get you to describe in detail, but we'll take them one at a time. When we say it is known for its brutality, what is meant by that?
Let me tell you. You have a country, a very small country. Sometimes we compare it to the size of Maryland. Within that country, 1 million people are dead. And they didn't die from anything. It's just at the hands of their countrymen. By machetes. More than 1 million people dead, actually. 2 million perpetrators. We don't have any government. Institutions, all the institutions are in disarray. There's no functioning police. There's no courts. There's nothing. So during that particular time, really Rwanda was destined to become a permanent UN protectorate or a failed state. And so this is, and not only that, when we talk about the effects of genocide, for all of us, it's not so much about people dying. You know, people can die, you know, an earthquake can kill people. But also it's the soul of the people. Dr. Ensign talked about the church. More than 80% of the people in Rwanda were churchgoers. I grew up in church. I was in a boarding school and all these things. And then you go and the majority of the people died in churches. So they became the burial grounds. There is no place to go. So you are talking about also the whole ethos of the people. When genocide ended, it was very difficult to even think in terms of how we are going to start rebuilding Rwanda. It took imagination. It took many different things. And there was no roadmap to really say, how can you heal from this? It has never happened before. Even in many genocides, it doesn't happen as fast and as in a horrible manner, the one we are talking about. As you mentioned, the women, more than 500,000 women were raped during genocide. You know, we have a whole generation of young people. A little bit older than Nelly, were born out of genocide. So you can imagine, for instance, when we talk, and I hope we'll address the effects of reconciliation, on how you can actually look in the eyes of those children who are a constant reminder of victimization. After you kill a husband, you are left with the children from the perpetrators. You know, and so that's why maybe even when you talk about the women and the sense of resilience that is unheard of in any place, you go from there, and that intimate reconciliation that had to occur for people to be able to look at the children, to understand. You know, people were, today in Rwanda, they are meeting 30,000 people for a conference on AIDS, HIV. Most people were infected with HIV during that particular time, including young children, not just grown-up people. So it was a total destruction. We never thought that the country would stand again for all of us, whether you were outside, you were inside. So that's where we were in Rwanda. All the instruction, all the institution had collapsed, including the family. You know, you talk about the church, you don't have any country, you don't have any government. And then also the family was violated in many different ways. So... There was an article, I think, in the New York Times, if I'm not mistaken, where they said that Harry had moved to Rwanda. You know, Harry was in Rwanda in that time.
It certainly sounds like it. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. I want to remind you about some shows coming up. In fact, one very important show that we're doing. Smart Talk will take a road trip to the governor's residence and a conversation with Governor Tom Wolf. You'd like to join us, go to WITF.org/events to RSVP. We'll be in the governor's residence, and you can have an opportunity, if you're there live, to ask the governor a question. By the way, if you can't attend but would like to ask Governor Wolf a question, just email us. It's smarttalk@witf.org. That, again, is coming up on December 11th. So be sure to tune in and RSVP if you would like to attend. During the first part of today's program, we're talking about the genocide in Rwanda that occurred 25 years ago. 800,000 to 1 million people killed, another 1 million displaced during that span. Tonight at Dickinson College, there will be a discussion on Rwanda at 25. We're joined by some of the participants in that discussion on today's program. Her Excellency Ambassador Mathilde Mukantabana, the Ambassador of the Republic of Rwanda to the U.S., Dickinson College President Dr. Margie Ensign, a scholar on Africa, has written about Rwanda, and Dickinson College student and Rwandan native Nelly Tita Netwale. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. And on Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So, Ambassador, a quick question I had for you about the genocide. And again, this was during such a short period of time, as you mentioned, 100 days in 1994. What was the rest of the world doing while these massacres, while these murders, while these rapes were happening in Rwanda?
Unfortunately, I have to say that the world pretty much stood by, especially the people who could have intervened. And in this case, we talk about the international community. It never happened. The Rwandans, the Tutsis of Rwanda were left to their fate. So the United Nations, the major countries, they were tiptoed around the issue of whether it was a genocide or not, but and some were complicit, totally complicit in the. And I think that Dr. Margie talked about it. We were left to ourselves, and as you said, the horror was unmitigated. It was but it was not inexplainable, because all this level of genocide got to where it got because people knew, and it was in broad daylight. It was a time of cable news. So it was not really a genocide that was hidden anywhere. Yeah. But the whole international community, the security members of the Security Council refused to acknowledge the Rwandan killings as genocide. And most importantly, because they didn't want to incur legal obligations under the Genocide Convention, to which they were signatories. And even the United Nations troops in Rwanda were withdrawn during that particular time when people were dying. So if you ask me, the international community completely failed in their mission.
Dr. Ensign, I saw you nodding your head when we talked about the rest of the world standing by.
No, the ambassador's completely correct. Everyone stood by and knowingly watched the genocide against the Tutsis unfold. The U.S. unfortunately lobbied against removing those troops from Rwanda. President Clinton originally said he didn't know, and then later when the information came out, apologized. He actually opened the Holocaust Museum during that time and said, never again can this happen, in May 1994, while the genocide was unfolding. The rest of the international community knew. So it's a horrible example of what can happen when there is no intervention. And of course, we like to think it wouldn't happen again now that media is pervasive, but of course it has happened since. So, but what is remarkable with everyone standing aside, is that now Rwanda is a beacon of hope on the continent.
And we're going to talk about that in just a moment. One question about the history, though. Was there any justice? The people who perpetrated this, were they ever held accountable?
Well, the ambassador may want to address this, too, but Rwanda established what is probably the most interesting, important, and effective post-genocide justice system in human history. It's called Gacaca, which roughly translated means trial in the hills. And over 2 million perpetrators were tried by judges who were also Rwandans trained to be local judges. It was an extraordinary justice system. I had the privilege of observing part of it with a former student of mine as his the murder of his family was held accountable. So Gacaca is something that's very important to understand and to learn from. But I believe there has been justice and to a great extent reconciliation in the country because after the genocide, this was the process used. It wasn't just justice, but it was designed to bring the country back together.
Mm-hmm. Ambassador, let me turn to you, and we'll talk about the recovery that has been made since. 25 years since the genocide, and by all accounts, Rwanda has made a remarkable recovery. How did that recovery occur? I mean, I don't know if I can say that very few countries have recovered from this kind of thing. This was a unique situation, but in a short period of time, 25 years, Rwanda has really made a comeback. How did that occur?
Thank you. The biggest thing was a mindset, because when we started the whole journey to recovery, it was not merely rebuilding Rwanda, but also almost reinventing it as a unified, peace-loving nation. So we started by explicitly acknowledging that it was up to us, really. You know, and we just talked about the failure of the international community, but during this time, we understood that if anyone was going to fix this, it was going to be Rwandans fixing it. And let me say when I say this, it was not a rejection of help from outside. Many NGOs and foreign government gave us considerable assistance. But it was simply a recognition that a durable solution of peace, security, and prosperity for Rwanda must come from Rwandans. And we needed to do it collectively. And to understand this was our country, our society, our government, our history, and our future. This is why we started to engage all Rwandans. A vision was started. There was a vision to rebuild Rwanda. And then collectively we started to implement the vision. Even to tomorrow, next year we are what we call the Vision 2020, and that was really articulating where Rwanda needed it to be, a middle-income country. I know that Dr. Maggie is going to talk about economic development and so on and so forth. But all these were articulated. We had the philosophy. We started by saying anything we are going to do, we have to do it in unity. We chose to remain together, chaff and grain, the bad and the ugly. We didn't say we are going to select this. That's why the sense of justice was important. And what she just described, that we needed to have justice to move forward. And then people, we brought the reconciliation process, brought people together. It's a journey that we take for a long time. It didn't end for the last 25 years. It will continue. But what I'm saying is that we chose to remain together, we chose to be accountable, each Rwandan is accountable, and then to think big, you know, to think that we are not a small country if we put all our energies together to deliver. And this is why all the homegrown initiatives that Professor Margie is going to talk about were meant for that. They brought people together. It was very comprehensive. Whatever we did in socioeconomic matter, whether it's what we did yesterday by doing community work, that has beautified our country. We do it together, and it brings people together. You don't need to come with a mandate to say you have to reconcile, but when you work together, you beautify your neighborhood, you provide for the widow, you build those housing, people come together. Mm-hmm. The peace baskets that brought women, the women of perpetrators and the women of victims, has brought them closer because they found that they have the same existential problems and they needed to address it together. So peace and reconciliation brought our country together, and we were able to get to a point we are because we are working together, and, you know, women and men. That's why we empowered our women. You know, Rwanda is unique in the sense that we are the first country where women are predominant in parliament, in our cabinet, it's 2020. You know, I mean, it's half and half. So we believe that each Rwandan, a woman, a man, have to come together to build this country, and you are committed, and you are accountable to it.
Dr. Redsine, what about economic development? I mean, what are the major industries? What are the major economic development forces in Rwanda?
Well, it's far greater than economic development. As the ambassador said in 1994, and as Nelly said, the country was destroyed. There was no infrastructure, no education, no health, no government. In 25 years, Rwanda has leapfrogged. And the ambassador just explained how it was done. It was not from the top down. Everyone was involved in setting these targets for Vision 2020, including the poorest, and that's why this is so extraordinary. The participatory processes that have emerged in Rwanda are really an example for the world. If you look at how far Rwanda has come in 25 years, life expectancy has tripled, as has GDP per capita. Healthcare is extraordinary. The advances, the declines in infant, child, and maternal mortality are greater than in almost any other country. As she said, they are number one in the number of women in parliament. And of course, I believe that's part of why they've made such tremendous progress. So we really need to look at Rwanda not just alone and in terms of its own progress, but as an example for the world. I believe one of the greatest things that's happened is the introduction of what Imihigo, which is one of these homegrown solutions where political leaders are held accountable for the targets that they have to set. So we really have an example of performance-based governance in Rwanda that's an example for the world.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a phone call from Chris in Mannheim. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
Yes.
An observation with regards to why the U.S. didn't intervene in Rwanda at the time. Just wondering out loud how much of an impact Somalia had on our unwillingness to intervene in Rwanda because of what obviously happened in Mogadishu with the Black Hawk Down situation. And my other quick comment is I wonder if humility by the Rwandans, being humble and contrite, has been the ultimate contributor to reconciliation and healing.
Dr. Ensign, thank you very much, Chris, for your call. Dr. Ensign.
I think that's an important observation. The U.S. was embedded in Somalia, and as we all know, lost troops there, and that occurred about the same time. There was actually good news in South Africa, the first elections, democratically held elections. So there were a lot of distractions. I agree with that. But we can't make the case that we didn't know what was happening. I think the Rwandans have a fierce determination to rebuild their country, and that's why we have seen this tremendous progress.
Nelly, as someone who was born and raised in Rwanda, in this country now, getting an education, I sense optimism when we were speaking before, and also pride in your country for the comeback that it has made. Are those correct observations?
Yes, they're very correct. I'm very proud of my country. I'm very patriotic, and we see a lot of the youth now, after genocide generation, very proud of their country, very proud to be able to get an education wherever they are, and like study to be able to bring back whatever they learn to bring back home, because we know that it's our mission, it's all of our, like, as Rwandans, it's our mission to regrow our country, rebuild our country, just because we know that we're the ones going to be living in this, and we have to show the next generation and the generations after that that after the genocide we have come so far, and it's our mission, it's our duty to keep doing that.
One final question, though. I get the sense also that you often hear when you're about the Holocaust and other genocides in history, it sounds almost simple when people say never forget. But from what I understand, that is a big part of what's going on in Rwanda today, that people haven't forgotten what happened during the genocide and before the genocide. I mean, the ambassador described that there's been a long history of violence and colonialization, that it is a situation where people say never forget or words to that effect. It's a big part of Rwanda, correct?
Yes, it's very important to know where we came from, our history, and how we are able to come from such a horrible time to be able to rebuild our country to what it is today. So it's important to know, to never forget, and to also know that we were able to make our country how it is today. So imagine what it will be like when we know we have the tools, we have the education, we have the hope, the peace, the future to build this country. So it's very important to not forget.
So I want to remind you that tonight at Dickinson College at the Schlechter Auditorium in Carlisle, Rwanda 25, and some of the participants in today's show will also be there tonight. I want to thank our guest, Her Excellency Ambassador Mathilde Mukantabana, the Ambassador of the Republic of Rwanda to the United States. Dickinson College President Dr. Marky Ensign, a scholar on Africa, has written about Rwanda, and Dickinson College student, Rwanda native Nelly Tita Netwale. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Tune in for tomorrow's Smart Talk. We'll be discussing an investigation into head trauma in high school sports. We've heard a lot about concussions and brain injuries over the last few years, but Brett Schultz, WITF's Transforming Health reporter, has done an extensive study or investigation into head trauma in high school sports, and he'll be with us tomorrow. Plus, you can leave a voicemail or voice memo question for one of our upcoming programs. More information is at WITF.org/smarttalk. Okay, now this is not going to be as hard a turn as what you think. I mean, when we're talking about genocide and you go on to any other topic, yes, it is a bit of a hard turn. But bear with me when we talk about this. When Christopher McDougal agreed to take in a donkey from an animal hoarder, he didn't think it would be that big of an adjustment to his family life. But the donkey, named Sherman, was in much worse shape than he realized. So Chris took on a radical donkey rehabilitation program designed not only to heal Sherman's body, but to heal his mind today. Joining us is Christopher McDougal, author of the book Running with Sherman, The Donkey with the Heart of a Hero. Chris McDougal, good to see you again.
Nice, Scott. Thank you.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. One other reminder, Running with Sherman, the Donkey with the Heart of a Hero, is WITF's pick of the month. Every month, WITF and Midtown Scholar Bookstore recommend a great book for you to check out or read with your book club. From biographies and novels to poetry, children's books, and more, we promote selections monthly on WITF TV, WITF FM 89.5 and 93.3. Read along with us as we discover literary finds that engage, enlighten, and entertain. And this month, it is Running with Sherman, the Donkey with the Heart of a Hero. Chris, before we start talking about the book, we had kind of a, we have a something to talk about that is very similar in that, or I should say some commonalities in that you were a journalist, still are, but you were a journalist working for the Associated Press, and you covered and reported on the genocide in Rwanda. And this was not scheduled on purpose. It just worked out that way when we had this schedule. But what were your observations of that time?
How eerie is that?
It really is. It really is.
It is strange because it was one of the most traumatic and formative experiences of my life. I was a reporter for the Associated Press, originally based in Lisbon, Portugal, but one of my main coverage territories was Angola, sub-Saharan Africa. I was covering the civil war there when the genocide began in Rwanda. So I very quickly shuffled over from Angola into Uganda, and then actually came in overland from Uganda across the border with the advancing army of the Tutsi Liberation Front with Paul Kagame. So I was actually one of three journalists on the ground in Rwanda during those early months of the genocide. And it's been something that has been a difficult thing to deal with for a long time. And I've actually...
For you personally.
Yeah, yeah. At the time when we got into it, I thought I was a pretty seasoned conflict correspondent at that point. But when you go into something like that, where the UN peacekeepers have been massacred, when every known form of law enforcement and civility has been removed from the country, and you're walking in the middle of this, you know, your heart's in your hands.
Wow, it's just hard to imagine. You now live in southern Lancaster County, an area commonly known as the southern end of the county. How did a city boy from Philadelphia get to the countryside with Amish neighbors living on a farm?
That actually Rwanda experience was a big part of it. You know, when I finally decided to get out of conflict reporting, I just had enough of these worlds where it is 99.9% of the population living in peace, and that 0.1% of dudes, and it's always dudes that are making life a misery for everybody. And we're seeing in our country right now, these old dudes who refuse to take into account anybody else's experiences and insist on their own power grabs. And when you have enough of that, you decide, I'm going to go the opposite direction and go to a place where there's none of that. And where I ended up was actually in Peach Bottom, Pennsylvania, which is about as far from the halls of power as you can possibly get. We don't even have a local government in Peach Bottom. You know, we are sort of just our own people down there.
Mm. So I want to move ahead quickly, and we'll, you know, move around on during our discussion, too. How did the donkey you named Sherman become part of your menagerie?
Yeah. How weird is that? I mean, I came out of Philadelphia, right? And then in sub-Saharan Africa, and I ended up in Peach Bottom. And we just became kind of hobby farmers. We started messing around. I never had, you know, pets growing up. This is a whole new thing for me. And we heard about a guy in the area who had a donkey locked in a stall, and all the neighbors are trying to free this thing. And because we had lots of space and, you know, only a couple of sheep and goats, plenty of grazing space, we agreed to take this donkey in, not realizing the kind of predicament we were in for.
Well, maybe our listeners can get an idea when you describe what Sherman looked like, the condition he was in when he came to your farm.
When we got him out of that stall, he was so lame. His hooves had grown out so far he couldn't walk. His teeth were literally falling out of his mouth. He had those dead eyes, those dead fish eyes. He'd been locked in the dark for years. And so when we first got him, the people who were helping us said, I'm not sure if this guy's going to live another day or two. You know, he hasn't moved. He can't walk. He's lame. And that began our sort of, you know, four-alarm fire emergency to try and keep this animal alive.
But that description, that the physical description of what he looked like, I mean, you mentioned his hooves, and I didn't realize, one thing I'll say about your book is I learned so much about animals by some of the background, the context that you provide, but that hooves, healthy hooves, are especially important to the donkey and, you know, a healthy life for a donkey. So the hooves, that was one of the very first things that had to be taken care of for Sherman to live beyond that day you mentioned.
Yeah, when we first saw him by light of day for the first time, we looked down, these hooves, they look like swim fins. They're so long and curved, and he was kind of splayed out. So we called a neighbor who's a farrier who trims hooves. And he came over and he got this look on his face of like, uh-oh, I don't know, man. Because donkeys and horses have to walk in order to survive. That's the only way they can process their food. Otherwise, they'll get colic. It turns a cement in their system and they will basically explode from the inside out. And this farrier looked at this donkey's hooves and goes, they're so long, I don't think I can trim them. They're beyond repair. And if he can't walk, he's going to die a very excruciating death and very soon. And this guy did something to this day. I think, man, what a hero. He took a hacksaw and got on his hands and knees under a creature that could have kicked his head off and began sawing through these hooves like he was cutting through tree limbs. And he saved that donkey's life in that moment.
Mm. Donkey Sherman was matted, had a lot of other physical problems as well, correct?
Yeah, across the board. He was riddled with parasites and diseases. But the overwhelming thing, the difficulty wasn't the physical, it was the mental, the spiritual, right. Because our good friend Tanya, who's a horse and donkey expert, said, it's his spirit. If you can't cure his spirit, if you can't give him a reason to live, so he opens his eyes every morning with a purpose in life, there's no way he's going to make it. You got to come up with a job for him. And I'm like, dude, I'm not a prospector. I don't have a job for a donkey. Like, how do I get involved in this mess? But that began my whole process of thinking, what can I do with this donkey that is going to give it a reason to live?
Well, what you came up with is not like, I have to say, Chris, not like a normal person would probably come yeah, up with. Yeah. You were familiar with, and you had this idea from the very beginning with Sherman that you would race him in a donkey race in Colorado. How did you ever think that this donkey would get healthy enough, both mentally and physically, to be able to race in Colorado?
Yeah, in those moments of crisis, your mental radar just starts to scan around until pings on anything. And when I had this friend Tanya telling me, you know, in a really kind of menacing fashion, you don't mess around with Tanya, he was telling me, you got to come up with a job for this thing. You can't just leave him out in the field. If he survives, he's going to need a reason to live. And I'm like, job. Oh, you know what? 10 years earlier, I'd been in Colorado, and I actually had participated in the World Championship Pack Burro Race. This is a tradition dating back to the 1800s when miners would strike gold and they would run to the nearest town with their gear on the back of their donkeys. And this became a tradition where these miners, now that they had gold, would bet each other and race each other. I tried it. I hated it. I decided I would never do this ridiculous sport again. But then 10 years later, I have a dying donkey in my backyard and my young daughters are looking to me to try and save this donkey's life. I got a woman telling me, you got to find it a job. And the only thing I can come up with is, you know what? Maybe I can teach this donkey to be my running partner. And then together, the two of us can go and try our luck at the World Championship Pack Burro Race.
Something you just said is very important. Running partner. This donkey race or races that they have throughout most of the western part of the country, it's not like a horse race where you put a donkey in a in a gate, starting gate, and they take off and compete against one another. There's a running partner along with prospecting gear, certain amount of weight that goes onto the donkey. So, I mean, you're a runner. So you had to be in shape, and then the other people that you employed, and I'm not, and when I say employed, I don't mean in the official sense of the word, but that you had helping you had to be able to run and be in shape as well with these donkeys.
You know, to me, this is what the real heart and soul of this whole adventure was about that partnership.
Yeah.
You know, as a non-animal person, I came at this from the perspective of like, oh, you know, animals, they're kind of like those furry servants in your house. You say sit and they sit and, you know, you throw it a treat. What I didn't understand until I began this process was for tens of thousands of years, humans and animals worked as teammates, as equal partners. They understood each other. And it's only kind of in the past 100 years that we've lost that art. But, you know, Cesar Millan, the dog whisperer, you know, he makes his living out of just teaching people how to walk their dogs. Like, how do you not know how to walk your dog? But most of us have forgotten that art. And so what I did for running with Sherman was I kind of did this scan across the country of trying to find those people who have maintained that lost art. And that's what I was trying to bring to the operation was, how can I actually truly partner with this animal?
Well, one of the things that is so remarkable about the book is describing the people that were involved in the training of Sherman and the actual race itself. Most of the book is about the training because, I mean, this animal, as you said, was very close to death, had to be trained, I mean, was afraid of almost everything. But there were other donkeys that had to be used to show him how to be a donkey. Flower and Matilda, where do they come into the yeah. picture?
So, you know, beloved Tanya, the woman who was the mastermind of this operation, she said from the beginning, now listen, if you want to try this operation, if you want to try this plan, there's two things you got to know. Number one, anything you want a donkey to do, you got to make him think he thought of it first. And number two, anything you start, you got to finish. You can't go halfway with a donkey and give up because that tells a donkey, oh, it must have been dangerous. So the key to unlocking Sherman's potential was by making him think that running for 29 miles in the mountains was actually his idea. And the way we did that was by basically borrowing donkeys. We kept throwing more donkeys at the problem until we solved it by getting two other donkeys and forming a herd where we had three donkeys and three runners, this herd of six creatures running together. That got Sherman excited. Unfortunately, that also meant that my poor wife, Mika, a hula dancer from Hawaii, now I'm handing her a rope saying, hey, look, I got you a donkey too. Got her, Matilda. We got a big running donkey named Flower. And then our good friend Zeke, who was taking time away from Penn State to deal with depression, he joined this crew. So suddenly you got an aging dude who's out of shape, a young kid dealing with a mental health issue, a woman who really wanted to be back on the beach in Hawaii, and three motley donkeys together are trying to train for this race.
Now, that's just a small portion of the people, because you, throughout the book, you introduce, I mean, you talked, as you said, you went coast to coast talking to professional donkey racers, got to know a lot of these people, and you learned so many lessons along the way, not just about donkeys, but about animals overall, right?
You know, here's the thing I'm trying to get my head around, Scott, is that I kept finding over and over again that people who are good with animals are empathetic and perceptive. And I don't know if they were that way in the beginning or whether their work with animals taught them you got to shut your mouth, open your eyes, and pay attention to what the other creature is feeling. But when there was ever an emergency, whenever I needed help and I reached out to an animal person, in a heartbeat, they're always there, gave of themselves in ways that were just miraculous.
All right. So you train for what, 9 months?
Yeah, just
nine
about.
9 months?
Right.
Which is a short amount of time for a donkey that was in the condition that you described Sherman was in. So let's go to the day of the race in Colorado. Yeah. Now, as you said, there are different distances that you can choose. But one of the real challenges, we're talking Colorado and the Rocky Mountains, was the altitude. Describe race day. How did you prepare for that altitude?
So, yeah, it was 9 months, but 9 months was enough time for us to suffer like three broken bones. You know, I broke a broken bone in my hand. Zeke broke his foot. Tanya broke her back. We finally arrive in Fairplay, Colorado at 11,500 feet. And one thing that was on my mind was I knew a girl from Pennsylvania had been here the previous year at the same altitude and died, literally died of altitude poisoning, altitude sickness. And I'm like, oh, my God, now I'm subjecting my wife and this kid, Zeke, to this race. So we had a choice at the starting line. Do we do the 29-mile distance or the 15-mile distance? We had trained for 29, but I thought, you know what? We better throttle back and do the 15, which at 12,000 feet was plenty hard.
I got tired just reading the book, I have to tell you. You're in much better shape than I am. But it doesn't matter where the three of you finished. All three ran the race. All three donkeys ran the race. It doesn't matter where you finished. As you said, it sounds like Rocky, that all you wanted to do was finish, and you did.
Tears in my eyes. I couldn't believe it. Just looking at my wife, looking at this donkey, and thinking, man, what a year it's been.
Mm. What lessons did you take out of that?
You know, most of all, this idea of patience and empathy, of trying to understand truly what the person or creature across from you is feeling before you make judgments and demands. And that, to me, is the big takeaway. If I can bring what I learned from working with a lame donkey to the rest of my life, I'll be a better person.
You know, one of the things that stuck with me when reading the book is that, you know, people kind of stereotype donkeys, if you will, that, you know, they're not fast, they're slow moving, maybe don't look so smart, you know, cuddly from cartoons, things like that. But this is a smart animal. I mean, and you really talk about the history of donkeys and their place in the world.
Yeah. In some ways, first of all, they're super affectionate. But here's the thing about it. The reason why donkeys have been treasured and valued is because they make up their own minds. They make their own decisions. And you can't talk them into something that they think is dangerous. And that's why they have a reputation as being stubborn. But that's also why up in the mountains in the Himalayas, you want a donkey, not a horse, because you can persuade a horse to do something wrong. You cannot persuade a donkey. And that's why if you get it on your side, if they trust you, then they're totally down for the adventure.
Chris McDougall, author of the book Running with Sherman, the Donkey with the Heart of a Hero. It's WITF Midtown Scholars Pick of the Month. I want to thank you very much for being with us. Just enjoy the book and love make a great holiday gift, I would say. Thank you very much for being with us today.
So good, Scott. Thank you.
Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be talking about head trauma in high school athletes. That's on tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in.